Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine others, and I'm reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Good morning, boys and girls in the wonderful wide world of what's going on out there and all you peoples. Welcome to another amazing effort of the After Rod and things that go bump in the bumpity bump 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 land. Tonight, we have a special guest, Tom Barzak, who is an author of several books about dragons and some other stuff, and he's going to talk to us all about butterflies that poop rainbows. Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Hey, Z, I'm really glad to be here. It's going really well.
Well, that's great. I got to start with, why dragons?
Good grief, that's probably the best question ever. But I just have always loved them. I grew up playing role-playing games, Dungeons & Dragons, when I was a kid, and just kind of fell in love with them then. But they really represent something bigger, and I've really gotten to explore my writing. There are... We fear what we don't know, and dragons have always been the great unknown. And in medieval times, they were the darkness, the shadow, the will-o'-the-wisp of the swamp. And no one ever saw them, but they were very much real. So there's just something about them I've always found fascinating.
So I'm going to go on to guess you've read Anne McCaffrey's dragon series, right?
Yes.
Okay. So her dragons are mostly, hey, look, those are cool and nice. And then we have other types of dragons that is like, that's just a great big worm, slicing and dicing and doing all that fun stuff. What kind of yours?
Neither one. When I started writing it, I decided to write, decided I wanted to write a novel, and it was going to be about dragons. I really had to get to what they were, at least for me, and how I wanted to write about them. And I really went back to that idea of the peasant in the woods, and he sees the bump, or hears the bump in the night, and the dragon was as real as this keyboard is in front of me, and though he never saw it. And everyone who ever told a story about him, they were very real, though they never saw them. So what I began to come to the conclusion of is not only are they real, but they're also in your head. And they're everything you don't understand, and they're the fear, and they're the whisper in the dark, and all these things, and they're a head game that they play on you. And so they kind of begin to represent something much bigger and deeper. They're the little corner of shadow inside of you. And as I wrote, I had to find some way, yeah, there's something physical about them too, but where do they do the most damage? And it came up with this idea of a dragon that is everywhere and everything. It's legion. It's in the trees. It's in your neighbor next door. It's in you. It's in everybody all the time. And it's the thing you've got to try. Everybody's got to slay their own dragon. And so I wrote the story about this dragon of legend is trying to come back and become physical once more, because it used to be. And right now, all it's got is the stuff I just mentioned. And that's all it wants to do is become a real boy. And can't yet. And so it's just, that's kind of what wrote the novel. That's kind of what drove the story. And almost the enemy became the hero, and it's becoming the hero to some extent as I got to explore it deeper and deeper and deeper.
So, I from what I understand, Mouth of the Dragon, Prophecy of the Everrun is the most recent release of yours. It came out like this February.
Yep.
And I know about a couple of your earlier books, Awakening Everrun and all that other stuff. And are these all connected stories or connected?
They are. They're connected. They're all part of a larger world. The characters are connected either through history or direct relation. But I wrote them, and I really believe any good story should probably be written this way. That Mouth of the Dragon is meant to be an introduction to that world, even though technically it's the second novel. The Awakening Everrun was a 5-part Kindle serial to kind of set the stage. But it's kind of like if you're watching Star Wars, you don't have to watch the prequel first. You can jump right into part four.
What prequel?
Exactly. And so anyways, that's what I wanted to do with this novel, and I believe that's the way I wrote it, and from what I've heard, that's what it's able to do. You don't have to read the other stuff, but if you want to get into it, you certainly can. But I'm hoping really with this one, you kind of reach a larger audience.
Cool. And,
that's the goal, and so far, I think it's doing the job.
And with Everrun, and I probably will mispronounce it at least once throughout the show, because I want to call it Everrun.
It's Everrun, but Everrun's cool too. Everrun is
Everrun.
I didn't have an umlaut on my computer.
Oh, really? For those people who don't know, what is that?
A little German abbreviation.
Yes, I am familiar with those funky little things. I just can never pronounce it right.
So, yeah, it's called Awakening Everrun, and I actually wrote that. I'd written my first novel, Veil of the Dragon, and I was sending it off to agents, trying to get it published, and I'm going to writers' conferences and just kind of learning the craft and the business of it, and everybody's cussing about 7 years ago, and everybody's starting to talk about build your base. And so you have someone to sell books to when you actually get around to having one. And I'd read Stephen King's The Green Mile, and I remember growing up those old dime store serial novels. And so I came up with this idea of doing it just on the Kindle only, a dime store serial novel. And I did it in 6 parts, and it was really fun. It was almost like, and my background's in arts and painting, and it was almost like doing performance art, because I had an overall story arc, but I hadn't written that story yet. And it was just coming from notes that I had from this novel I had just written. But the actual serials, it was kind of up to grabs. So I wrote one, and I just tried to make a commitment every 2 or 3 months, I'd put out another one. So I came up with a structure, and I wrote them one at a time. And I had no idea what was going to be on the second one other than it had to do this. And it was a very satisfying experience to do that. And it really helped build up some readership. And so when my novel did come out, my first novel, Veil of the Dragon, I actually did have people to buy it.
Okay, if you're going to start answering questions before I start answering them, I'm going to smack you. By the way, Jack in the chat room says hi.
Hi, Jack.
Jack as in Jack Finley, one of our fellow peoples in the Hell series. We'll get to that in a few seconds. I was going to start with the with Everrun. You did that as a self-published thing, or was that published through somebody else?
It was self-published.
Okay. And how did you find doing the actual self-publishing side of things? Was that something that was like you got a good reaction to, you got good flow-through on?
It went really well. I mean, considering I started from zero, I had never done anything like that before, and I had a lot of free time. I was recently divorced and wasn't sleeping a whole lot, so I had a lot of time to kind of pour into it, which was a big part of it.
Nobody needs sleep. Sleep is overrated.
Sleep's for suckers and chumps.
Exactly.
It went really well. I remember the first time I got someone sent me a message from Australia, and it was an art student who was asking me permission to use the part one of that serial use that as the narrative for his college thesis project. And it was the coolest thing. And so he sent me updates of his paintings as he was going and watching this other person describe what I was putting into words. And it was beautiful.
Nice.
And it's just things like that. But numbers-wise, it did really well. It didn't make a ton of money, but when you sell them for 99 cents, you don't make a lot of money. But I really got to build a readership out of it. And so when a novel came out in the first one, I was able to actually have something working.
Cool. I think you kind of tailed off there a second. So after, with the Everrun, and building your base, and like what were you using for building the base? Twitter, Facebook, anything else like that, or just general out there?
mostly Facebook and word of mouth. I still don't understand Twitter. I'm trying really hard, but I haven't entered the circle yet very much. I'm dipping my foot in the water with Twitter still, but mostly with Facebook. And, you know, one of the things that my background is as a painter, and I don't know that a lot of authors view themselves as artists. Whenever I give talks, that's the first question I ask, and maybe 1 out of 10 view themselves as an artist. And I really believe we are, as writers, with an art, just like ballet or painting or anything like that. And when you go to a gallery, you don't buy a painting, you buy an artist. When you're going to buy a Warhol, you're not going to buy something that looks good, you're going to buy a
Rembrandt. We're not buying Warhols here, because that stuff is too expensive.
Okay, well, something cheaper then.
Okay.
But if you're going to a gallery, that's kind of how it works. And I think it's that way with literature, too, with writing. Sometimes you'll go to the bookstore and find something cool, but usually you're going to buy a Stephen King, or you're going to buy the guy who's making all the big dragon shows on HBO. That guy, I can't remember his name. Anyways, you go there to buy the author, not the book. And so that's kind of what I got. That was the biggest advantage of that. I wrote it with Facebook. I got to sell the idea of myself as a writer. And that's really what got me this movie.
Well,
you got to write good, too. But.
Yeah, yes, writing is a very important part of that process.
It is.
So from Everoon, then you go and end up meeting up with an actual publisher. How did that end up transpiring?
Well, that actually was a part of, that was one of the biggest advantages of doing Awakening Everoon. I was about 2 books into the 6-part series, and I saw a person I didn't know floating around Facebook. I kept seeing him in the same places I was going. And and so I made contact with them, and it ended up being Janet Morris. And introduced myself, asked her if I could send her a copy of my serial I was doing. I still didn't have my novel out yet. And turns out she liked my writing, and then I got to meet a lot of you folks. And just start to build those relationships, which to me are probably the most important thing of all. During that process, I made a decision to my first novel was self-published as well,
and that was Veil of the Dragon.
That was Veil of the Dragon, and two things helped me make that decision. I think were probably the 2 most critical factors. One was I saw this article called The Long Tail, and it talked about this idea of 1,000 fans. That if you could have 1,000 fans who are willing to drop $20, they were talking about painting and the arts in general. But if you have 1,000 people who support the idea of using artists, and they're willing to drop $20 a year on your craft and support you as an artist, then you just gross $20,000 a year.
Yep.
And if you have 5,000 fans, you can quit your day job. And that's, you know, we're not talking New York Times bestseller. We're not talking 5,000 people. That's not a lot in the World Wide Web and big thing. Now, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a while to build that up. But that was the first thing that kind of made, maybe I can go a different way, because I was having some luck with agents and publishers, but not enough. And the other one was an author, and I don't have her name in front of me, but she did the wonderful thing of publishing basically her royalty statement. She was a New York Times bestselling author, first time on the New York Times bestseller list, that sold 6 novels. So she was, you know, where I wanted to be. She was just, you know, she was there. Her publisher had given her a $30,000 advance on that book. And she was in big league. First print run, sold out first print run. Couldn't do better. And she didn't make enough to pay back her publisher.
And
so all that work, sold out, New York Times, she still was in Dutch to her publisher. She still was in debt for her publisher for the money they'd given her.
Well,
and it's just like, that's nuts.
I just wanted to jump in on that for a second, because I know some people don't understand how the, they gave you an advance. Like, that's an awful lot of money. Yeah, it's an advance on sales. And some people don't understand that that means it has to be paid back.
Yeah, it's not your money until you earn it back.
It's like,
loan.
They do have a lot of money in the publishing industry in the traditional trade markets, but there's a reason they have a lot of money. They got all these tricks and things that is just like, crap, man, that stuff will cut you and it will cut you.
So, yeah, it was just, those were the two big eye-opening things I saw. And again, I was at a point in my life where I was recently divorced. I'm raising three boys on my own. And I needed money, basically. And so I kind of started looking at some other models, and I was talking with Janet Morris quite a bit at this time, and I made the decision to go ahead and start my own imprint, and I self-published this first one. And again, I had more time then than I do now, but she taught me how to kind of paginate and set it up and do all these things. It was extremely helpful to me. Wrote a blurb on the back of the book for me, and I couldn't have done it without her. So anyways, I put it out, and then it did okay. It did what it was supposed to do. It brought me a couple of bags of groceries a month for the next couple of years, and which is what I needed. And it helped me build a base up and taught me a lot about marketing and business. So it got me to the point where I'm at now, where I got, and Percy and Press graciously decided to pick up my second novel, Mouth of the Dragon, and I couldn't ask for more right now than that. It's so far we're starting pretty good out the gate.
Excellent. Now, I'm looking at your book list here on the old-fashioned Amazon, and I know that one, I know that one, I know that one, I know that one. We're actually in a couple of books together.
I know.
And I just had to look up when I saw that one was listed there. I was like, wait a sec. I have that book. I'm in that book. Oh, crap. He was in that book. What Scares the Boogeyman?
Yeah.
Which was a fun little collection.
I've got them all stacked in front of me right now for reference.
Huh?
I've got them all stacked in front of me now for reference. I'm looking at them.
Oh, crap. So I can ask questions and you have answers on all of them.
Perhaps.
Okay. Well, then let's go to the back to some of your earlier stuff. So, artist turned architect, and from what I understand on your Everrune books, that's your artwork.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And in the first novel, I illustrated that as well, Bell the Dragon. I've always loved those. I remember when I was a kid, there were those coffee table books that had the illustrated plate every chapter. And I just loved just flipping through the Robinson Crusoe and those storybooks. And they weren't kids' books, they were like family books or something. I don't know if mine's a family book, but I wanted to do that. And that's what I got to do with Vale and with the Everrune series. I decided to, it's one of my strengths, so I decided to kind of
hang my hat
on that a little bit.
That keeps the cost of production down by not having to pay another artist to do the artwork.
Yes.
So that's cool. So inside Everrune, there's a bunch of illustrations inside too, right?
Yep. Each of them is set up into four chapters, and each chapter has a illustration to go along with it. So four in each one, plus the cover art.
Okay, so with the architect, what kind of architecture?
I design schools.
Schools?
Public schools, yeah.
That's just like a square box, though, isn't it?
Not anymore. Not when I do it.
Oh, good.
But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I do work all over. I live in Oklahoma, and I do clients all over the state. I work for a firm called Williams & Associates, and that's almost all we do is educational facilities. But I get to do theaters in that. I get to do gymnasiums. I get to do food service. There's a whole spectrum of stuff, not just classroom.
Nice.
So
it's
pretty nice.
So, let me guess. AutoCAD?
Yes. Absolutely.
Excellent. I like AutoCAD.
I made the point to Rivet.
I'm sorry?
Rivet's another program. It's like a 3D modeler that they're starting to move
through.
I personally like the old school.
Gotcha. Yeah, I guess more of that stuff is all done in 3D now. It's like, it's been ages since I played with AutoCAD.
Yeah, but most of the people can't draw in 3D. That's the lost art.
Huh?
They can't draw in 3D, and a lot of people can't think in 3D.
Right.
Because it's warm, so...
Right, you know, yeah. Like, it's the whole visualization process. How do you see point A to point B? And it's like, I don't know where they are. It's like, okay, then don't do it. So, you are also in the Hell series with Persid
yes.
Publishing.
Yes.
How many of the books are you in? I think I know you're in Poets and Dreamers. Was there any of the others?
No, Poets and Dreamers. I've sat. That was by the time I got in with everybody and with Persid Press. I missed some of the ones that came before that when they rebooted it, but I got into those two. And then as I was finishing up Mouth of the Dragon, I kind of had to sit out for the next one or two. And I'm hoping to, there's another one, I guess, looking at Lovers in Hell. I'd like to get into that one. So I'll try to work up a story up for that. So
with Hell, how do you feel like playing in Hell? Personally, I love playing in Hell.
I think it's fantastic. I like it because everything's fair game. And most of the work, and you know, this isn't every story has to be this way, but for me, and it's not a question of happy endings, but there's got to be some sort of redemptive, I always love the hero's journey, so there's got to be some redemptive quality. And there's no more challenging place to write about redemption than in Hell, because you can't ever really get there. So I got to write a couple of stories that were related that had to do with hope and friendship and trust and real basic fundamental things. And real, you know, platonic love for each other in this hellish place. And it was wonderful. And then the history of it all, there's so much history in those books that you get to get into. And every time I've written any sort of historical fiction, it almost writes itself.
Well,
my story. Go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, I was going to let you finish.
No, go ahead.
Well, for those who don't know what the Hell series is about, it is a series that started in the 80s, kind of went to sleep for a little while Janet Morris, the editor and anthology creator, and then was reborn 5 years ago. Holy crap, 5 years now. Sorry, I just had a moment there where I realized 5 years. Wow, okay. So.
You've aged 5 years.
I'm not aging much at all. I'm dead. Doesn't matter. So.
I remember seeing Heroes in Hell in Walden Books when I was a kid. In high school, I remember walking to Walden Books, which is no more. The bookstore in every mall, and I can't remember which one it was. It's on my shelf over there. I can't see that far. Had Julius Caesar on the cover.
Yeah, Crusaders.
Wasn't Crusaders, but anyways, it was one of the first ones, and I remember seeing it, and it was at the time it was too over my head. I don't think I ever actually bought one. I'm ashamed to say. I wish I had now. That would have been really cool. But I remember looking at that, and I remember Feed's World.
Yep.
And all those stories that she wrote in, and to be where I'm at now, and actually get to work for her and write with her is just a real privilege.
Well, see, we're sharing now, because that was pretty much like me. It was like, oh, okay, I'm going to comment on something on Facebook. It's like, oh, yeah, look, these pictures, it's just okay, stuff like that. And then it was a reach out. I was like, wait a sec, who is this I'm talking to now? Holy crap, this is that Janet. Oh, crap. Because I remember picking up Heroes in Hell when off the shelf at the world's biggest bookstore, which is what it was called, because it was a huge place, and then picking up three of them afterwards right after bat. It's like, how come I'm going to read all these? And it's like, wow, I'm now working with Janet. It's like, that's awesome.
She is very cool. And she is probably one of the most supportive, altruistic authors I've ever met. You know, I'm not just trying to butter her up.
And very, very strong with the red pen in the editing process.
Absolutely.
Which is... good, because that's what you need.
Right. Well, and she knows what's good and she knows what's not. And but she also gives her, her writers, people that write in the Heroes and Hell series and some of the other anthologies, I believe, great latitude that not every publisher would do, and really allows them to explore where they need to go with these stories.
I concur. So where do you think you're going to move yourself forward? I mean, what is your next project? What do you got coming up on the horizon to work with?
Well,
how many more books in your Dragon series?
I got one more after this one. I've already started it. And probably 40 pages into it. So I set it down briefly. I'm fixing to pick it back up again and dive into it because I want to have something to follow up. And it picks up the minute Mouth of the Dragon ends. So I really want to, I don't want to have a long time in between. So I'd like to get that finished up in this year. And and have that, you know, certainly do that final draft process here within the next 10-12 months.
Cool.
So doing that, and you know, there's a couple other projects I'd like to work on. I'd like to write a lot more with the Heroes of Hell series and Janet and Chris. I've had this book of poetry I wanted to do at some point, which
poetry.
At some point I'll get into. I know. Everybody got to do poetry at some point. But,
that's my
something. You what?
You know that's my thing, right?
I do. I love your poetry, all the time.
Excellent.
And, it's something I want to do. And I've had my own little hero journey that I've gone on. I'd like to explore that, but I just don't know how to approach it. I expect it's going to be some sort of drawing and painting and writing all together. So that's one project I want to do at some point, and then. The other one is it's a novel I started, and I sat down to the, some of these other projects, but it's an architectural thriller, which I don't think I've ever seen before.
Sorry, architects and thrillers not necessarily go together.
They don't go together normally, but
yeah.
I really believe you got to write what you know, and I'm not a forensic guy by any way, shape, or form, but I know what makes buildings fail. And so I came up, I had this idea of this architect who's, one thing architects, where we fold a lot is pride and vanity, I think, is one of our deadly sins that we get into. A lot of ego in the profession.
Oh.
And just kind of part of it. But an architect who's so in love and with their work that they don't ever want to see their buildings grow old. So, you know, buildings with progress don't always last a real long time. They might last 20 years or 30, and then they get demoed down and something else. So she's found a way. And this is a grand dame of architecture. She's one of the first woman architects in the profession, in the story. And she found a way to have all of the buildings be destroyed before they ever really aged. And she's found a way to do it, and no one knows about it. It's just her little thing. And then, so now she's on her deathbed, and the story, the hero of the story is her son, who is estranged from her. And something goes wrong on one of these demolitions, and someone dies. The FBI thinks it's a terrorist attack. And so this big investigation is going on in the background as they... try and find this out, and the whole time his son is trying to get to know his mom, and so he finds out that she's the one who killed these people, and accidentally or not, and that's kind of a part of the story, and then what he does with that. So.
Cool.
We'll
Very
see
cool.
what happens, but it's I think it'd be a good story.
Okay, well the next kind of question is kind of like one of your standard kind of writerly type questions, is like, where are you drawing some of your inspiration from, besides just the architect?
Well, this is where the conversation gets weird.
Excellent! Weird! That's what we dwell on.
I know. You gotta write what you know, and honestly, you know, I write a lot of fantasy. I don't like most of the fantasy that I read. It's one of the problems I face, first of all.
Okay, let's stop right there. Who do you like in fantasy, other than yourself?
My favorite right now aside from my peers at Tertiate, is Jim Butcher. He wrote Codex Alera series. He's got a new series out now that I just started the first book on. And he's actually out of Oklahoma, originally, for you, but he did the Dresden Files.
Yep.
And he's just a very talented writer, but there's something about his work that is intelligent and it has a concept. He's not trying to browbeat anybody, but I read his series, I read his books, and something changed. I couldn't tell you what it was, guys, but it made me question what I thought and what I felt and what I believed. And I kind of, as an artist, that's important to me. And most fantasy that you see up there, not all of it, I'm not knocking anybody, it's just, it's, there's so many tropes, there's so many stereotypes, it becomes very easy to be a lazy writer.
It's all Tolkien-esque.
Well, and Tolkien wasn't lazy. His stuff has a lot of depth and weight to it.
Yeah, but it's all derivative is what I meant.
Yeah. But what problems is when I come in as a writer and I just write, I write elf, I write dwarf, I write dragon, I write wizard, and half the work's already done for me. It doesn't make it good, bad, right, or wrong, but at some point I've got to take responsibility for what I put on the page. So if I choose to keep it with the stereotypes, I've got to have a reason. If I don't have a reason to keep the stereotypes, I shouldn't be writing it. And so...
okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that's when I first started writing this whole Everrune stuff. These were stories that started a long time ago for me. I really had to look at what I was going to buy off on and what I was going to try and recreate. And dragons and wizards were two of the things. There's not an elf in any of the books. There's no humanoids.
No elves.
No elves. And I decided I wanted, if you're in France and suddenly you're in the woods in Germany, it's pretty dang foreign. And you're not going to speak the language. You're not going to know the culture. It's kind of like elves going to dwarf land. And so I decided I didn't want all that extra stuff. I just wanted to write with real people. So that's what I did. And they're all human, but they have their own races and their own cultures and their own languages and religion. And I really just got to sink into that. And so that was one of the early decisions I made. But to get back to the original question, you know, when I was, and we're making it weird for someone, I hope it doesn't. I had a daughter named Olivia who passed away 13 years ago. And one of the things, and she was my only child at the time, and that was a little pivotal part of who I am, is what happened when that happened and walking through it afterwards. And so there's a lot of death and rebirth in my story. There's a lot of transformation of the changes I've had to make in my own life on a somewhat spiritual nature have been the same way. You know, I'm trying to be the better man that I can be so I can raise my three sons and not making some of the mistakes I made when I was younger. All those things are kind of death and rebirth, a hero's journey. And so there's just a lot of that in my writing. And I never want to get where I'm trying to be a bully pulpit or my beliefs on anybody else, but I don't think it's possible for me to not write without some amount of allegory.
Well, we all write from a place that's strong within ourselves, and that's generally why we write, is because it's coming out from somewhere, so our color is going to be on it no matter what we do with it.
We hope so, yeah, I think so.
But
I think it's good.
Oh, I was going to recommend two writers for you if you haven't read them before.
Please do.
Samuel L. Delaney has a book called Dahlgren. It's a weird book, but it's all about the personal journey transformation. Okay. And Jack L. Chalker, any of his books, especially The Well of Souls.
Chalker, Chalker?
Chalker, yeah. He's mostly science fiction, but it's also about transformation, a lot.
Well, and I think if you go back, I just ordered this great book. It's supposed to come tomorrow, and it's about Tolkien and my mind's going blank today. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis?
C.S. Lewis. And
the inner strength? That hidden strength.
Yeah. Anyways, someone wrote about, they're writing about them and what they went through in World War I.
Right.
And the really cool thing about them, they were contemporaries. And they talked together a lot about what they were trying to do. And they went about it slightly differently. But that's what they came up with. And that's why we have our elves and our dwarves. You know, Tolkien, which was traditional myth, but really articulated it and made it his own. And C.S. Lewis did the same thing. Speaking of C.S. Lewis, I've always described Heroes in Hell, if anyone had asked, as a cross between the Screwtape Letters with Dante's Inferno. And Screwtape Letters is a fantastic book by me.
Cool. Okay. So in the whole confluence of being far as marketing and trying to build your market base, as it were, you do much in the way of conventions?
I do. I'm starting to. I've done a few out of state, which I probably won't do for a little while again because they were kind of lost leaders financially for me. so I've done it a couple times. I'm not going to do that again until I, you know, at some point things kick off. They'll actually will pay me to come out. But I've done a lot of local ones. I do a lot of writers groups, and I'm speaking at a small one-day convention in Muskogee, Oklahoma, the eastern part of the state. I'll be on a couple panels and do some big signing stuff.
Your Facebook page says you have a release party coming up this weekend or something.
I do.
Plug it.
It's Mouth of the Dragon release party. It's an awesome little store here in Norman, Oklahoma called Loot and XP. It's a board gaming cafe. And my kids love it, and it's the coolest store ever. And people who work there are just phenomenal. And anyways, they're letting me do a book signing there, so it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to do some reading from the novel, and we're going to read and sign books and play board games and have a blast.
That sounds like you're going to get bored. Playing board games.
Probably.
Playing board games. Come on, I'm punning here. It's what we do.
Yes. So, looking forward to that. And starting to put stuff in bookstores around town, full circle bookstore. And open Edmund. I'll remember later. Too late. We're off the show.
Yeah, about 10 minutes after the show's done. That's generally the way it works.
Probably.
Have you tried going into any of the large conventions? Not necessarily as a guest, but just, hey, what the, holy crap, look at all this crap.
I have. I've gone in to this big one called SuraCon in Oklahoma. I've been to that one. And then, of course, LibertyCon. And the Fandom Fest was probably the biggest one I was ever at. And those are the biggest ones I've been to. I'd love to go to Gen Con sometime. And I grew up dreaming of going to Gen Con, and then there's Dragon Con.
Yeah, Dragon Con is what I was going to just say. Dragon Con's actually not.
I'd love to.
Dragon Con's actually not the biggest one in North America either.
What is it?
San Diego Comic Con.
San Diego Comic Con?
250,000 souls in the door.
Wow. Have you been?
I have yet to go to San Diego, but I have been to Dragon Con, and I have been to Gen Con.
Yeah, I said Dragon Magazine when I was a kid. I was seeing the little page ads in the back. Man, one day.
Well, it's changed a lot since the old days. From what I understand, when I went, it was just a fun, hey, everybody comes out and just chills and does stuff. Now it's more, a little bit more...
Perky.
Professional. Is the word I'd want to say. It's like, okay, you guys do stuff. Yeah, okay, I can buy stuff or I can do stuff. I'm going to go do stuff. See ya.
Yeah.
But the Toronto one, which I've done now a couple of years, go straight here, is about half the San Diego Comic-Con was, 125,000 people in the door. Okay. Holy crap, that's a lot of people.
I don't think SuderCon ever gets that big. It might be a couple thousand.
Yeah, and I've meant for the last 3 years to try and get to LibertyCon as well, but I just never quite seem to pick it a good time.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it's
oh well.
Hard to get to, one of these years we'll get to meet up.
Yep. One of these days I'm going to meet all the Percy Press people somewhere.
Sometime. I've got to meet a few. I got to meet Jack.
Yep.
That's awesome. We're going to hang out at LibertyCon. And I've met Janet, Chris, and Bruce Durham. I've met him. I've met, there's another guy. He's actually in Oklahoma. I can't remember his name. He's in one of Hell Books a couple of years ago.
Jason?
No, not Jason.
I don't remember who's in Oklahoma, but Bruce Durham is actually, I've met him a number of times. He's a local boy. He's a fellow Torontonian.
And, yeah, he's one. So, yeah, I've got to meet a few. Everybody's been just phenomenal. Great bunch of people to work with. And, the writer.
So, you may or may not know, I'm from the horror side of things in the writing side of things, and my perceptions have been quite strong about a lot of the horror community. What do you feel like, which you've just sort of gone into, is about the fantasy writing community? Is it fun? What are they like?
Yeah, the people are great. I think the best part, you know, writing is such a solitary task. It by nature has to be, I think. But when you get involved with the community of other writers, particularly like those mostly fantasy and horror, it's this community of support, this community of support and criticism both. In my background, again, I've been through. I've stood up and had my paintings critiqued and my projects critiqued, and now I get to have my writing critiqued, and it's such an essential part of it. You've got people that you trust enough to be honest with you and tell you the truth, that they, this is crap, or no, this is good, keep this, leave that, and being willing to trust them is paramount. And so I think they're all really pretty good. Everybody's most part. The hardest working group genre I've ever met, though, is the romance writers.
Is the which?
Romance.
Oh, God. I'm not saying nothing. I know too many of them. I know too many of them.
Hardest working. But when I first started off, that's who I friended mostly on Facebook. That's who I got. They're the most, you know, hospitable. And you know, back 10 years ago, 7 years ago, the deck was really stacked against them in the publishing business. Now it's kind of wide open with all the way it's done now. But back then, they were the only ones self-publishing back then. And they just worked harder than anybody I knew. And so I tried to absorb a lot of their work ethic.
Well, that and the fact that they truly understand the concept of you build your crowd, you work these people, you actually get out and get off your ass and find people to make friends with and network with and bring them into your fold. And they understood that back then because that was how that works. And it works even more so now. I mean, for me, when I tell people, I say, hey, what do you do? It's like, talk to people, make friends with people. It's not like, hey, can I be your buddy? It's like, hey, I hear you having similar interests to me and stuff like that.
Yeah. One of the funniest conversations I ever had with one of these writers was I didn't know how to write Kiss. And so I got a hold of a romance writer and sent her some of my stuff and said, tell me how to do this because I don't know how to write it. I wanted it to be a certain way, and I knew she would know how. So she gave me some good pointers about how to write Kiss, especially a first one. So that was good.
Yeah, I can imagine. I could imagine trying to do a romantic scene is going to be. Yeah, it's one thing to know how to do that. It's a completely different thing to know how to write that, so that other people don't say, "Ah, that's crappy."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or, God, that sounds like porn.
Or
like, no, not what I was shooting for.
Or worse than that is like, ew. That would be the worst part.
That would be the worst.
Yeah, but no, I mean,
Life's all fun, right? Write it down.
Exactly. You write what you know, you write your experience, and you put it down. Let me have a question for you.
Shoot.
I've always believed, and this might be a cop-out on my part, but I kind of go into the assumption, and my experience with writing is, the story is already written. This is where it gets a little bizarre. Somewhere out there, this novel that I'm in the middle of writing is already done. It's real. It's out. What I get as the author is I get little windows into this story. And I get little snapshots. Sometimes they're in order. Sometimes they bounce around. My job as a writer is simply write down what I see in a way that someone else could understand so I can transcribe this story that's already happened. And I can kind of see where on some level that kind of takes the responsibility off of me. But on some level, that really is how I write. As opposed to sitting there, I got to come up with a name for this guy, and I got to think, what does he do for a living? I just kind of watch and write down what I see, and it's just kind of like a movie constantly in front of me. What's your experience? What do you think?
I sit at the computer, I start hitting things, and then I wake up and say, oh, hey, crap, I wrote something.
It's pretty much the same one.
somewhat, and then somewhat is I also approach it like an architect. You design it, you lay it out, you put a plan together, and then you fill all the holes.
Yeah.
So I made
an agent at one point I was talking to, and she taught me, you're an architect, now you got to go back and paint between the buildings.
Yeah.
Because I was it had all the structure, but I didn't have enough description, so I got to go back and fill the spaces like you just said.
Yeah, and you find lots of different writers have different styles that go between the different ways. I mean, Stephen King spends pages and pages describing things, and then you have all these other newer horror people that say, brevity, go quick. I was like, yeah, but I like to describe things. I like to play with the words. I like to play with the music that hounds behind the eyes and that sort of thing. Yeah. So this is where I get a little weirder on some of my writing, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and somebody just said hit the computer with a stick, and it's like, yeah, okay, I'm good with that.
Hey, have you ever heard of something called synesthesia?
Yes.
Okay. I kind of believe I have. I've never been diagnosed, but I think I have a little bit of it. And for those listening, it's basically your senses are crosswired. So
like you smell color.
Yeah. Some with profound synesthesia would smell color or taste sound. And there's an example I read about of this chef who didn't eat chicken was a spiky ball. He saw a spiky ball in front of him. That's how he did chicken. And so sometimes when I write, I get my senses crisscrossed sometimes. And when I'm describing things, and I've got to stop and go back, and it makes sense to me, but it may not make sense to the reader.
Yeah.
And I'll use colors to describe sounds and vice versa. And it makes for sometimes beautiful writing, but sometimes I kind of rein it back a little bit.
Well, as we like to say in poetry, that's the shiznit. That's what it does, yo.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I didn't really want it to sound like that. I had a different set of words in my head, but they didn't color right.
That was totally different.
Okay. totally. So now, do you longhand write or do you computer write it?
I computer write it, but I do both. And one of the things I've had to learn over the years is I very rarely do I have 2-3 hours to sit down and focus on my writing. So I've gotten to learn to write sometimes 15 minutes at a time. And I've got to learn to bounce around a little bit. So basically, I don't have any excuses for not writing, like writer's block. Because if I'm stuck here, there's always something else I could go do. So I do it with computer, but if I don't have one and I've got a story in my head, I'll pull out my phone and I'll type it in that. Or I keep a notebook with me at all the time, most of the time, and I'll write in that. Sometimes just strings of dialogue without any description, and then I'll go back and I'll expand on it when I get to the computer.
So, as I like to say to a lot of people, notes are your friend. I'm just saying, it's an important thing where I work, because it's like, okay, you got to communicate between people. You got things, you did something, they did something. It's like, if you don't put the notes down, how the hell is the other guy supposed to know what's going on?
Exactly. Yeah, you're not going to remember. Back when I had college, I had a college. For a little while, I was a janitor in the dorms at the university in town. And I was writing songs all the time, constantly writing songs. So this was back before cell phones. I was in the dorms. So I pick up the dorm phone and I call my answering machine with cassette tape in it. That's how old I am. And I'd sing into there while I was supposed to be working so I could have the song, so I could get it. I knew if I didn't, because I wasn't writing now.
Cool. And do you consider yourself a pantser or a plotter or a mix?
A what or a plotter?
A pantser or a plotter?
Pantser or a plotter?
Do you plan your stories out, or do you do them winging them off the cuff of your pants?
I have to have some structure. That's the architect part of me. And I think there's a structure that has to be in a story. You know, if certain things don't happen at a certain point, I think the story makes it a lot harder for it to be successful. But outside of that loose story arc that I write with every novel, or a short story even, I just watch the movie. And I know at this point and this point, something bad has to happen. So whenever those points come up, I'll put them there. And the stuff in between, I just kind of let flow. I let the story kind of write itself to some extent. And this is where the arty farty part of me gets in there, but I don't think it's my right to dictate what happens.
What?
The story has some voice.
No! You gotta get the stick out and hit him with the computer. Or something like that. I don't know.
Something like that.
It's whatever it is. So
yeah, I don't think it's already written, and you just kind of got to follow it, and I got to transcribe it in an intelligent way so the reader can understand it. But you know, that's something you don't hear about a lot. The reader is part of the equation too.
Well, that's totally something I hear about all the time, and that comes from a marketing perspective. Product, meet consumer. Consumer, I don't like your product. Go away.
More than the marketing side, I think something's missing if I write a story and even if you just gave them away. It's not about the money, but if you wrote a story and no one ever read it, it's only half completed.
Exactly.
It's kind of like if you did a bunch of paintings and you never showed anybody. Half the magic of that painting is the discussion between the viewer and the painting.
That is true. Art being the perception in the eye.
Yeah. If you tell a campfire story, you told it 10 times in a row, I guarantee you never use the same words in every story. Each story is slightly different, slightly nuanced, slightly different words. Same plot, same story, but different language.
They have scientifically proven that.
Yeah. And I think with writing, if I'm doing a reading, I have no problem changing the words in my own book.
And along that lines, they also had, you have 20 people in a row, and they say one sentence at the beginning of the one side, and then towards the end of the side is like completely different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is scientifically proven factoids.
I think as writers, we get too caught up in the printed word to some extent and forget the story.
I get caught up in older words, and people say, what the hell does that word mean? It's like, look it up!
Give me a good one.
Obsequious.
Ooh,
really?
Yeah, really.
It's Shakespearean. Think of it as the obsequious toady is the way that Shakespeare always used to use it, and I always think of it as being like a used car salesman. So
it's kind of dodgy, shady.
Kind of sleazy, skeezy, scummy.
Okay, I like that.
Yep. That's a criticism I get sometimes, is I like to use big words and words that don't seem to fit nowadays. It's like, no, they totally fit. You just have to actually understand what they mean.
Well, one thing Janet talks a lot about, a book has to find its reader.
Correct.
As much as a reader needs to find a book. And, you know, I do a lot of flowery writing to some extent, and I try to rein it in, but that's part of the quality of my work. And big words are part of the quality of yours. And so some of that we kind of got to rein in, but some of that is part of our voice.
Yeah, and like you were saying earlier, I mean, a lot of it is you do have, if you're writing a story, you want to be read, you want people to enjoy it, you kind of have to make sure they can.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yep. So we've got about 4 minutes left. Is there anything that you wanted to highlight?
Well, I think, again, I'd like to invite anyone and everyone to... to check out my novel, Mouth of the Dragon. And I really think it's, and I'm not meaning it's kind of strategically, it's a different kind of dragon, it's a different kind of fantasy. And I hope it's a book that once you step in, you just get lost in. And so far, that's what it's gotten to turn into for a lot of the people I've heard back from.
And I have to say one thing, it's a very pretty cover. Who did the cover?
Gorgeous. Roy Morrison did the cover, and he is a phenomenal graphic artist with Perseid, and he just did an amazing job.
Yeah, no, I like the greens and the golds in that. That actually really pops and makes it look really cool.
It does. And I love my little dragon. I got my drawing on the cover. I'm pretty excited about that, too.
I thought that was one of yours.
That's the little dragon. So I was pretty stoked about that. Now, he did a great job, and all of Perseid's books are great. There's a lot of great anthologies out there. Heroica, the Heroes of Hell series, is another Heroica book coming out in the near future. Walter Reen is another author with Perseid who's very talented, one of the most talented authors on there. And he's did a great job. And he's got stuff with Perseid. It's a good bunch of writers, and I encourage you to check out their website at www.theperseidpress.com. You can always go to my website, which I still need to update, but it's www.tombarzak.com.
Spell Barzak. Spell Barzak.
B-A-R-C-Z-A-K.
Oh, look, you used the Z word as opposed to the Z.
Yeah.
You must be American or something.
I'm American.
American, yeah.
American, M-E-R-C-I-N. American.
And how about on Facebook?
And on Facebook, you can find me on Facebook on Tom Barzak. And you can go to Amazon for my author page on there and find all my work there. Another author who's done a lot of good work with Perseid, we've dropped his name a few times, is Jack Finley. And he's another amazing author. He's got a voice that really is unlike a lot of people I've heard. So highly recommend his stuff as well.
Awesome. Well, I just want to say thanks for coming out and joining on the show. Appreciate it tremendously.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. I appreciate it. Nice talking to you. Nice hanging out.
And it's great for people who come to the show regularly. Look at all those people in the chat room. I'm going to start saying some names. Wardog, Jeff, Randy, Morley, Jack, and now Emily. Everybody else, I want to appreciate you all coming out and visiting. I want you to all appreciate coming and checking us out in the archives. And follow the Facebook, the Twitters, the whatever the hell else is all out there. Come on back again every Wednesday. Next week we'll have another guest. I'm going to keep it a surprise for now. 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time every Wednesdays on this same Bat Channel, Bat Time, every freaking Wednesday from now until infinity. Just do it and have yourselves an after-rotten good time.
Have a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their pick.